Campus FM presents 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to this anniversary series, remembering 100 years of women on campus. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I shall be looking at this theme from many different angles, the sociological, the statistical, the anthropological, and the historical. I shall be asking questions about life for female students and academics on and off campus, yesterday and today, and possibly also tomorrow. I'm very pleased to have with me today Professor Jean Kalea-Ajous and Professor Lillian Atsopardi, with whom today we shall be discussing the theme of feminization in the medical profession, with special emphasis on Malta. Welcome to you both. Just a few words about my guests. In 1999, Professor Jean Kalea-Ajous gained her MD from this university, and in 2005 she became a member of the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland. In 2005, a member of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and in 2007, she gained the status of Clinical Specialist in Obstetrics and Gynecology. In 2014, she was awarded an MSc in Clinical Embryology, with a distinction, I might add, from the University of Leeds. And in 2012, she was awarded a PhD from University College UK, and with a pass without corrections, and anyone who has anything to do with the PhD will be vastly impressed by that. Professor Kalea-Ajous is at present head of department and associate professor at the Department of Anatomy at the Faculty of Medicine and Surgery here at the university. She's project leader for the EU Joint Action Project, national representative on the European IVF Monitoring Group within the European Society of Human Reproduction and Embryology, obstetrician and gynecologist with a special interest in assisted reproductive technology. Also with us is Professor Lillian Atsopardi. She studied pharmacy at the University of Malta, Faculty of Medicine and Surgery. She completed an MPhil on the development of formulary systems for community pharmacy, and her PhD thesis led to a publication in the United States of the book Validation Instruments for Community Pharmacy, Pharmaceutical Care for the Third Millennium. Professor Atsopardi coordinates teaching and research of pharmacy practice. She has been invited as an external examiner for postgraduate degrees in different schools of pharmacy. She is head of the Department of Pharmacy at present, and she was elected onto the Executive Committee of the European Association of Faculties of Pharmacy and is currently president of the association. In 2017, she was admitted as a Fellow of the International Pharmaceutical Federation for her contribution to the advancement of pharmacy education. Earlier this year, she was admitted as a member of the Royal National Academy of Pharmacy of Spain, and last week received the Fellowship of the European Society of Clinical Pharmacy. Congratulations for that, Professor Atsopardi. So I'm looking forward to hearing your opinions about feminization in the medical sphere within both sectors, medicine and pharmacy. However, perhaps we could first look a little bit at the historical context. Professor Kalea-Ajous, or perhaps from now on I can call you Jean.
You're calling me correctly, which is very good. I'm not Jean, I'm Jean.
Very good. Good point to make. I read with pleasure your academic oration on the graduation of the MD students in 2018. You made some historical references that really made one realize how recent, really, female emancipation in so many areas is. Perhaps you could recount some of the trials of the early UK female MD graduates.
And when you think about it, in ancient Greece and in ancient history, there are records of, for example, a certain queen, Merit Ammon, who was the first chief physician, who was a female, as far back as 2700 BC. And there is the other mention of another physician, Metrodora, who in ancient Greece had written the first book of medicine, which is still available after this day. But then in the 12th century, there was a ban on women attending any form of education, having any form of education, including obviously university. And that kept on, so from the 12th century up till, 859, when the first female doctor graduated. Her name, so, was Elizabeth Blackwell. She literally managed to creep in the medical course by accident, because she managed, she was very educated. She came from a family where the father allowed her to read. Allowed her to read, because it was very unorthodox to have a girl know how to read. So she did study the rules and regulations well of the university in New York, and she found a loophole, because it said that this university prided itself on admitting any person. And when they banned her from entering because she was a woman, she said, "So you're saying that I'm not a person?" And on that argument, she managed to go in.
The girl.
Yes. They did make her life miserable during the course, but she plodded on, and in 1859 she did graduate as the first female doctor since the centuries. This made news, and another Elizabeth, this time in the UK, Elizabeth Gerrit Anderson, heard of this achievement, and she also managed to enter the medical course. When she told this to her father, he wasn't against her entering university. And remember, at that time in the UK, there was the setup of this Royal Free Hospital, which was admitting both men and women in terms of having their education, so either as nurses, and they allowed her to enter the medical course. And again, when you think about it, this was in competition with King's College and Imperial College, who admitted only men, and they were considered the prestigious ones. So when Royal Free, which is part of University College London, started admitting females, it was kind of looked down upon. But obviously nowadays, UCL is at par, if not more than, in terms of achievements, with the other two. And this Elizabeth Gerrit Anderson actually then graduated a few years later in 1865. Together with the help of Elizabeth Blackwell, they did manage to set up the first hospital, which was mainly dealing with obstetrics. In fact, nowadays, the maternity wing and the gyno wing of UCL, of University College in London, is named after Elizabeth Gerrit Anderson. But it's interesting to note that previous to her, there's actually another less well-known female who went by the name of James Berry. So she actually had to live like a man and dress like a man and managed to graduate as a doctor and lived as a man, and it was only, close to her death that it was realized that, after all, she was a female. But she was so passionate about medicine that she actually had to live her life as a man in order to be able to graduate and practice medicine. And also, interestingly, the first doctor in Europe, the female doctor in Europe, was in between Elizabeth Blackwell and Elizabeth Gerrit Anderson, and that was Frances Hogan in Switzerland. So she was actually Frances Hogan in Switzerland, was the first female doctor in Europe, that's in Switzerland, but the first female doctor in the UK, it was Elizabeth Gerrit Anderson in 1865. It wasn't easy for her either, because, for example, there was, there still is, this very high-impact journal called The Lancet, which actually, had a very derogatory remarks.
Yeah, I can quote it from this.
Exactly.
The Lancet in 1878 read, "A woman as a doctor is a conceit contradictory to nature and doomed to end in disappointment to both the physician and the sick."
Mm-hmm.
And another quote, Sir Richard Douglas Powell, president of the Royal College of Physicians, who in 1907 declared, "Women ought not to be encouraged to enter a profession for which they are constitutionally unfitted."
Exactly, exactly. And the main reference, ironically, was to the fact that obviously in the first 2 years of any medical course, you have to study anatomy and obviously have to do the sections. And it was deemed very unfit for a woman to, that she would faint and that she would not be able to tolerate it, and it was not normal for women to do that. But through sheer determination, we managed. But when you think about it, this was 1907. It's not like ancient, it's only like, just over 100 years ago. So only a few generations ago that this was happening.
And we managed to have our first MD, Blanche Huber, in 1925. So
yes.
we didn't do too badly.
Exactly.
And you also mentioned in your oration the fact that Malta first became aware of the presence of female doctors in World War I.
Exactly. So that's also a very interesting effect because, I mean, Malta has been labeled as the nurse of the Mediterranean. I mean, after its contribution to the health in World War One. But if you look closely, I mean, there were actually 82 female doctors who came from the UK. So, so first you have this in 1907 where the president of the Royal College is saying no, women should not be allowed. But obviously the men were going to war and there were many casualties and, you know, women suddenly, you know, they turned on women because they were needed. And obviously they didn't shy away. And actually, only in Malta, 82 female doctors were shipped over and they were running several hospitals which were set up all over the island in order to look after the sick soldiers who were coming from Gallipoli as a result of the World War One. And in fact, they were recognized because they were given the Order of the British Empire. They aren't so famous, you know, I myself didn't know about this. I mean, I always had the impressions the nurse of the Mediterranean and Florence Nightingale and the language, but they were actually these 82 ladies, lady doctors, who served as a springboard for women in medicine.
Perhaps I can turn to you now, Professor Tsopardi. What were the origins of the pharmacy course? I know there was the pharmaceutical chemist course, PhD, which did become quite popular among women almost immediately after their initial admission to the University of Malta.
That's right. In pharmacy, the school, the PhD was the original degree that was structured. Pharmacy goes back to the time of the Knights of St. John, when we do have archives in the historical documents in Malta, which already state that pharmacists used to accompany the physician during the rounds to help in optimize therapy with the very little armamentarium of drugs that was available at the time, of course. Then when women started to be eligible to further their studies, the pharmacy area was identified as a very appropriate, that's the word they use, for the female profession. Because, and at that time, it was because the appropriateness was associated with the flexibility that you can work in a pharmacy, because that was the major area that a pharmacist was going to develop as a career. You can work as a pharmacy with flexible hours. And then as pharmacy education progressed, Malta was always very advanced in the way that pharmacy education was structured at the University of Malta within the European region. And then the BPharm course started. And actually, if you look at numbers, you will see that way back in the 1950s, for example, the largest proportion of the candidates finishing the program were females. Sometimes you have 12 females and 2 males. And this trend we kept seeing all along because of this flexibility. It's also interesting to note that today we still have this gender imbalance, let's put it this way. So it's an area where there's a lot of feminization in the pharmacy as a profession, not only in Malta, even in our school. And it keeps being related also to the flexibility. But nowadays, the flexibility is not only related to the flexible hours that you can work in a community pharmacy, it's actually the flexibility of the profession itself. Because you can work in many diverse areas, both for those female pharmacists who would like to work in industry, there are possibilities of those opportunities. And they also come along with a number of family-friendly measures. So the flexibility goes in terms of what you'd want to do as a profession, as a female pharmacist, and also how you want to organize your work-life balance in terms of the opportunities that are coming up.
I've interviewed various people for this series, and in fact, even Blanche Uber gained a PhD after she graduated as an MD, and works mostly as a pharmacist for the rest of her, unfortunately, rather short life. She died about 40. So there was this idea that even though they became doctors, in actual fact, they ended up working as pharmacists. So I think that this flexibility has been going on for a long time. And at the time, female doctors, I heard from one doctor who graduated in 1952, not a lot of people wanted to go to female doctors. So they used to use the pharmacist as an advisory place to go, especially for women. So they were fulfilling a function within that pharmacy. Some of them who are actually doctors themselves, but they had a function within society. It's actually quite interesting.
In fact, when you look at the pharmacists in community pharmacy, maybe we think that the main area, the main responsibility is handling medicines. I mean, getting the prescription, dispensing, advising you on the medicines, or you have a problem and you are discussing. In fact, the main contribution of the community pharmacist is this advisory role, or what I prefer the coordinating role, because many pharmacists, and many of those were females because of the gender aspect, in the village community pharmacies were actually the focal point for the housewife and going. So the pharmacist being also a lady herself and discussing not only the health-related issues of the children and the husband and herself, but also other social issues that also evolved, for example, against education of the children. And these female pharmacists in these community pharmacies were also fulfilling the social advisory role on educating society about health, about the importance of preventive care, the importance of education, and being a pharmacist who has completed a university level education, they were motivating the families to get their children to further their studies. So there was also this female motherly role that came through in the society.
Professor Kaleadjus, I'm quoting Professor Joseph Cacciottolo here, something he wrote, I think, for the local medical
the
journal,
MG, the MG.
Exactly. Between the years 1925 and 1982, only 33 women qualified in medicine from the University of Malta, whereas between 1983 and 2014, a total of 636 women qualified. One presumes that this is not equally so worldwide. Obviously, we're talking about Malta, but
of course, Malta at this point, and I think it's been like this for at least a good number of years, at least even from my time. I graduated in 1999. We were already at least 50-50, male and female, and even the few courses before me, I mean, it was like that. Obviously, in other countries where female education is still, no, not as high. I mean, they are not given that possibility. But I would say, I mean, they will get there. I mean, once there is education, I mean, and there are equal opportunities for boys and girls, I mean, they will get there. They equally have the same brains and the same capacity. But what's interesting is that although you've got for a good number of years the same percentage, if sometimes more women than men graduating as doctors, if you look at the positions then in hospital and the number of consultants, for example, which is, let's say, the highest position in terms of the medical degree, I mean, getting a consultant position and having your own team. In the general sector, so I mean, I'm not talking capability or in the private sector, but in general sector, there is, up till now, even up till this day, even though so many female doctors graduate and work and continue, when it comes to opportunities to consultantship, there is a big discrepancy, and in some fields more than others. And even if they manage to make it, there's still discrimination. So we're still at that point. So even though we have advanced a lot in terms of offering our girls the same opportunities, the reality is that when it comes to the marketplace, the job, there is improvement happening, and it's not just a question of having family-friendly measures, because the family-friendly measure is not only the female who needs them, it's the whole family needs that. So it's also changing the mentality of the men, and that, obviously, they need to contribute, that the children they belong to both of them, the family belongs to both of them, and it's a balance, and ultimately, if there's that balance, there will be more fruitful for the society and for the family itself.
A question for you both, really related to this. What are we really searching for? I mean, I've discussed this issue of this, the scissor graph, you know, where you start off fairly equal and then suddenly the blue line goes up and the pink line starts to go down. Is it equality of numbers? Is it equality of opportunity? Perhaps there is equality of opportunity up to and including graduation, as we've been saying, yes, but afterwards both in academe and in the workplace, because this also, I'm referring also to within the university itself, how equal at the end of the day are we vis-à-vis our academic staff? I don't know, perhaps you'd like to say something about that.
Well, yes, it's an interesting point in terms of the opportunities. Over the years, we have had a large number of female pharmacists in the workforce, but the top positions in private sector and public sectors were mostly taken up by males. And this has changed over the last couple of years, where probably for many reasons. One being the factor that Jean was mentioning earlier, that the individual needs to have a support structure where there is an understanding that being a female, the female pharmacist has a career progression. Now, one thing is to show that there is a career opportunity, because if the family does not see that the female pharmacist in the family can progress to a top-level managerial position, then that space is going to be taken by the male partner in the family, right? So one thing is that you expose that female pharmacist can get those opportunities on the job or in academia. In fact, in the Department of Pharmacy, we have a ratio of about six pharmacists to one male in our academic staff. We are also seeing that in the workplace, we have in the private sector, for example, top positions of quality management in the pharmaceutical industry to release medicine, so it's a very high responsibility job, being fulfilled by female pharmacists who have the support from the family, because they're seeing that this position is a career development, and who have also took up the opportunities that the Department of Pharmacy laid out for female pharmacists to further their studies. In fact, we have a number of these graduates now. When you look at our doctorate in pharmacy program, which is equivalent to a PhD in specific area in pharmacy, it's a professional aspect. Again, there we see that more female pharmacists are taking up that opportunity for further studies. And nowadays we know you further your studies and then you want to progress your career as well. So, the opportunities are now, we can say that by having a career structure in the private sector and having a further studies opportunities in the university, that will demonstrate to society that female pharmacists should also be given the opportunities to further their career.
Professor Cartetolo, in his article, suggests that maybe men and women have different objectives. Maybe men are attracted to jobs in finance, IT, which he suggests are perceived as less arduous and shorter career paths, as well as means of offering more lucrative prospects early in life. Books such as It's Going to Hurt by Adam Kay probably though bolster the image of medicine. So, Jean, what do you think about that? I don't know whether you've read that book.
I did. It's a very good read. It's a very good read, very humorous, I must admit. And there are many others. I mean, and interestingly enough, they're always written by men who actually look at medicine and, like, they feel like they're going in for something where their ego is going to be boosted. And then at the end, when they graduate and when they're actually on the job, they realize that there is no glory that they've gone in for.
At 2 o'clock in the morning, when you've been on a very long shift.
Exactly, having to do, or ruffled up. So there's no romance, and not just romance, it's the power, the ego, And I don't fully agree that men are not attracted to enter medicine. Men are attracted to enter medicine. I mean, maybe I'm generalizing, but they do look at the ego, at the status, you know, you see them on the first day on freshers, like, you know, and especially when it's their first day of surgery and they're entering medicine, when they're entering hospital, you see them with their suits and their that, and obviously by the first week they have to get rid of that because they are running about and they can't stay in their suit. Anyway, now we've changed it to a uniform, so that's better. So they might go in for the glory, I mean, and maybe already money, and maybe even the specializations that they choose for might be the ones where there is more, it's feeding a bit more their ego, like, you know, the surgery, you're there, you've got the female nurses assisting you, and you're there, the boss. So, yes, there might be attracted to those. Yes, and obviously, as a female tries to emulate that, they try to kind of, let's say it's not that easy for her, you know. But if I look at the females, it's not really the ego. I mean, it's more the care side, I would say. And they do take up maybe the less fancy jobs. I mean, when it comes to specialization, again, I mean, it is changing now. I mean, now that there are more of us, I mean, the field has to change. But I mean, when it comes, for example, to pediatrics, where you have to deal with anxious parents, I mean, parents, not just anxious moms, and crying babies, you tend to find a bit more females attracted to those, even though you do find males as well, but more females attracted to those. And even when it comes to, for example, I'm moving on to specialization now, I know, but I must admit that if I look, for example, at the cohort in my year, those specializations where you didn't need to go abroad to specialize, so you knew that you finished your 5 years and you could do your specialization completely here in Malta, they tend to be favored more by girls, by women. So things like GP practice and things like anesthesia, where all the training could be completed in Malta. You could go abroad for some, you know, finishing touches, but you could get the specialization here. They were taken up more by females because obviously they were then settling down and thinking about their fertility. So they tended to go in those specializations. And again, the field is now changing though.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. I would have liked to have been longer. I'd like to thank Professor Jean Kalea-Jules and Professor Lillian Atsopardi for coming to talk to us today about the feminization of the medical professions in Malta. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to 100 Years of Women on Campus. If you would like to hear the programs again, just go to www.maltauniversitybroadcasting.com and click on webcasts. Join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
You have just listened to 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri.